Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
We have tried to get this. I've wanted to have this guy in for a while, and it never has worked out, mostly because most Fridays, I think he is at home dusting off his multitudinous national newspaper national newspaper awards and Ontario newspaper awards. And he built a special wing on his house just to handle all the trophies and plaques and everything else. You've read his work. He's written many of the very popular long form, especially pieces that the Spec has run over the years. His name is John Wells. John, thanks for coming in.
Scott, thanks for having me. And yes, dusting and long form journalism. That's my two specialties.
Your two specialties, two expert areas of expertise.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? It's good then that you can do those two things because they tie in together for sure, obviously. We were just talking off the air, totally unrelated to anything. We weren't going to talk about this, but you're a guy who's written about and had interest, I know, in American politics over the years. And we were just talking about, I don't know if anyone heard, we don't talk about American politics on this show almost ever, mostly because, not that there's not interesting things, every show, every station, every website, it's all people talking about is Trump and Biden. And I just, you know, I try to steer clear because I figure there's enough other things we can do. But reading the story yesterday that Joe Biden now has announced that his uncle in World War II was consumed by cannibals. I was like, really? Okay, we're there now. We've reached the point now where we're telling stories about crashing in Papua New Guinea and being eaten by cannibals.
It's not going to help Joe's rep for bending the truth on occasion and making up stuff over the years, that's for sure.
I spent a summer in Papua New Guinea in the middle of the jungle, and I can vouch for the fact that simply going to that island does not get you consumed. I'm not sure if he's ever been there, but lovely people. Yes, there was once upon a time in some corners a history of cannibalism, but it's not like, you know, servicemen just fell from the sky and were immediately put into a pot and boiled.
It sounds like they should have the next Survivor show, perhaps, there. If there's going to be cannibalism involved, I'm in. I never watched that show, but I'd watch that, I think.
Survivor Cannibal. Yeah, if you get voted out, you're immediately taken somewhere and eaten.
Taken to the barbecue. Yep.
Yeah. Suddenly, Survivor looks like that book Alive of those those rugby players from in the Andes Mountains.
Yes.
You know what, Paul, it's weird. We're just, this week, politics here and there. That is just a bizarre story that, of course, his press secretary today was trying to say, well, he was being symbolic. And it's like, I'm pretty sure Joe Biden at this point doesn't have the mental acuity for symbolism. It's not there. But then here at home, I don't know if you saw this tweet today. From Justin Trudeau, we've cut the cost of cell phone plans in half since 2019. Your cell phone bill in half?
Not the last time I checked, but maybe I have to check again.
I'll tell you, you can check all day long. I'm pretty sure that the answer to that is absolutely no. I've almost reached the point where I think that politicians at this point just assume there's so much noise in the world that we're not going to check anything, and somebody's going to go, oh, they cut the bills. That's fantastic.
Well, and you know what? And it's so polarized that I suppose for Trudeau, those who are all on board are going to find some way, I suppose, to support that. And those who are less than enthused with him will jump on it, and rightly so, it would seem. But that's kind of where we're at, echo chambers of opinion, really.
Maybe he just miswrote it down. Maybe his tweet was supposed to be, we've raised your cell bills by half, because that would make more sense.
It was just a typo, perhaps.
I just don't understand how some of these things are put out there without a suggestion or a belief that we're going to find out.
Maybe not as many editors of his copy as he would like.
Well, I mean, do you think there's something to the idea that there's just so much going on that we're not going to, and hopefully if we throw out 50 things, 5 of them will stick in your brain and you might believe them, and then if the other 45 get disproved, well, so what? We scored points on the 5.
If you think about politics, you know, decades ago, where everything was sort of, I think, picked over with a fine-tooth comb by the media and people. Nowadays, as you say, there's just so much volume of information that perhaps that, you know, things will get lost in the shuffle, and nothing sticks. I mean, if this claim he's made is proven false, the staying time for these things in the news cycle is so short. You know what I mean?
You're right. Yeah. That within 24 hours, we've moved on to something else. I really wonder, and I've thought this before, I really don't believe that if Watergate happened today, that it would lead anywhere.
No,
Because people would have become bored of it very quickly. We would have moved on to something else. And unless there was sex involved or something else, Watergate would never have mattered.
Yeah, no, the whole, yeah, that, you know, where every day is being advanced a little bit at a time.
But incrementally.
Exactly. I mean, I remember when Princess Diana died, and I was at the I hadn't been in the Spectre that long. I can't remember what year that was now, but I hadn't been in the Spectre very long. And I remember my editor calling me in after like day four of our coverage, saying, "So how can we advance the Diana story today?" And I was like, "Geez, we're still." But that was kind of the nature of it. You would kind of push stories along, nudge them along day by day. And nowadays, just the cycle is crazy.
Well, even 9/11. I mean, after the initial thing of 9/11, I was working as an editor at The Spectator at the very beginning of that. And every night we would get new stories from the LA Times and the Boston Globe in particular. And again, incremental things about the guys who took over the planes or the. But I think it would have been. People would have become fatigued of it and we would have been on to something else. Amazingly, it's crazy to say that when you consider that. But. We're 6 months on, and the October 7th thing, we're no longer talking about what happened October 7th. We're talking about a million other things related to it, but that event is gone.
Yeah, no, certainly with tragedies, you know, the school shootings in the U.S. and that sort of thing.
That's a 12-hour thing now.
Yeah, exactly, and which is a sad statement from many angles. But it's here today, gone tomorrow. It's crazy.
But maybe if a president's uncle today was found to be eaten by cannibals, that would last for more than 24 hours in the news cycle.
It would get some A1 treatment, you would think, for a little while.
For a day or two, and then we'd move on. Then we'd probably bring in some expert on dining and try and spin it into a feature thing, a lifestyle. Oh, only going to get ourselves in trouble. John, last week there was yet another, the latest in the endless string of discussions at City Council about the LRT, this one about who or how it should be operated, whether it should be a private consortium with Metrolinx or whether it should be the HSR and public or whatever. And as has been the case with literally almost every single discussion of this project from day one, it was an exceedingly close vote with council split. This one was 9-6 ultimately, but Narinder Nan was not there because she had a medical appointment, I believe. I don't want to presume which way she would vote, but it could have been 9-7, which means one vote and you're a split council. And, you know, it got me thinking that many years ago, there were suggestions that the LRT should be put up for a referendum in the city, and that was rejected. And with every single issue getting bogged down in these kind of debates, I go back and I wonder, would it have not retrospectively, would it not have been a good idea to have a referendum? And then if it was yes, the people who are against it step aside and we move ahead and do this. And if it was no, it dies. But it just seems like without that, it has become this endless fight.
I'm not a big fan of referenda. That's the plural of referendum. Of having referendums.
You're the right.
you hope that the political leadership can do what's best for their community and not get into sort of a populist mindset. But for something like this that goes on for so long, you start to get to the point where it would be nice to have that as having set the table at least with popular sentiment at the time, so that and for people like councillors who support continuing with it, it would give them the political cover at least to say, you know, the people wanted this. Here's Exhibit A, the referendum kind of thing. And so I do, you know, the longer it goes on, the more that it seems like that would have been.
I don't think you can do it now.
No, I think it's too late. And so let's. You know, I wouldn't support that back in the day, but I think in hindsight. I think that would have been a great idea, given how complex and expensive and controversial the project. At least it settled even just sort of the whole notion of, does the city want it? Because people will say, we never wanted it, we wanted it. Well, at least that would give some sort of, you know, quasi-scientific argument.
And there are those who say that the election between Fred Eisenberger and Vito Scrowe two elections ago was a sort of essentially a referendum on this, because Vito was very much against it and Fred was very much for it.
Right.
And okay, I mean, I can take that, but at the same time, there are other issues involved in mayoral races. There's personalities. I don't think you can say with absolute certainty that was a referendum. There were people who were surely using it as a referendum, but I don't think that you can broadly say that did that.
No, I think, I mean, you know, Fred, obviously a lot of political experience, a big name in Hamilton. I mean, in terms of Fred's position on other progressive causes and so on, you could take LRT or that mix, and he still would have won. I don't think it would have been considered a referendum on anything like that. But I think that doesn't count as far as that goes.
It's here's the thing too about it is that I really believe that it should be a cautionary tale. I mean, I don't know if we needed to have a referendum on the stadium, although that was also a hugely contentious issue. But on something that is going to be affecting the city in a way that is as impactful as the LRT would be, I remember the pushback against the idea, but there are lots of places down in the States in their municipal or their state elections, they have referenda, all the time. They've had it on marijuana legalization. They've had it on LGBTQ things. They've had it on all kinds of stuff. And I don't see if it was part of the municipal election thing. So you're not paying extra. It's part of the ballot. And then you could have presumably voted for Fred as mayor, but against the LRT, or voted for Vito as mayor, but for the LRT. As a lesson learned, I think for the next time, because again, I think it's too late for this. But as a lesson learned for the next gigantic project we're going to do, maybe do this right off the bat.
It offers another piece of data, if you will, to the mix. And I was down in Oklahoma City back in December to research a piece on Shea Gilgeous Alexander, and down there they voted, they had a referendum. A couple of days before I got there on whether the city should pay for a new arena. They had a big campaign. There was the yes side, the no side, and they voted in favor of the city financing this arena down there, which, you know, down there it's a big deal using taxpayer money. But to your point, yeah, I mean, they vote on everything. It's a different political culture. They vote on everything down there. But you know what? At least you can, again, political cover. You can say the people wanted it, at least by the referendum, which is, it's not everything, but it's something.
And if it passed, I would hope, and maybe I'm naive, I would hope that if we had had one and it passed, those who were opposed, as I say, would say, I may not agree, but the people have spoken, so we are going to sort of step aside here and smooth the tracks, no pun intended. And then that we could have been done with this thing by now. Or it could have been off the table and we could be on to something else by now. But it's this endless thing. And literally, John, and you've probably seen this too, every tweet about LRT, every story that's written about LRT on any website, CHML, the spec, CHH, whatever, every comment is back and forth. The people hate this. No, the people love it. We have truly no idea which way the people are with this, except for a bunch on each end that are very outspoken.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I guess the notion of the, you know, silent majorities or the squeaky wheels and all that sort of thing. And with LRT, you get a lot of squeaky wheels on both sides of this.
Absolutely.
But in terms of the great silent masses out there that have an opinion, we don't know what they think, really.
And I mean, you know what? Here's another one that maybe, and again, I'm not a fan of doing referenda. We're going to figure this out in the break. Where it's going to cost a fortune by having a special election, but you make it as part of the municipal election, so it's on the ballot and it's already as part of the thing. I would argue for the urban boundary. Now, I know they had a poll that was done, but the ballot was not sent to everybody, and it was organized as, you know, one of the groups was heavily organized. I'm not saying they would not have won. I'm not saying the close the urban boundary wouldn't have won. I don't believe it would have been 90%. And that, again, seems to me like one of those significant city-altering decisions that probably the people should be asked about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I suppose someone could argue that, you know, one of the challenges with that, with more direct democracy, as it's often called, is providing enough information and education to the public so they can make an informed decision. You know, like with the urban boundary, how is the question phrased? Are people being made aware? I suppose, you know, with the online information, it's pretty easy for people to find things out. So but you would hope that the people would be voting based on some context.
You know what it might do? It might make the voting, if it was part of the municipal election, it might actually drive up the voting on the elected officials. If people care about these issues, maybe they go out and vote, and they also vote for someone, and we have more than a 30 or whatever it is percent turnout for city politics.
Yeah, it's always very paltry. You're right. Yeah, people could be motivated by that. You know, that
it could be a lure. It could be a lure to get people in to participate. But yeah. As I say, I really believe it's way too late now to do this. We're too far down that path. We're going to. I'm not convinced the LRT is happening. I'm pretty sure, but there's also the chance we got to run. There's also, I think, a chance that when we finally see what the cost of this thing is going to be, that the higher levels of government are going to go, wait a second. We want to think this over. I think it's still going to go ahead, but yeah, something to think about for down the road. The next time we have a gigantic project, it might be this might be a good learning tool. We were just talking about referendum, which, by the way, according to the Cambridge Political Science, Cambridge University Press says the plural of referendum, John, is not referenda, as we have been saying. It's referendums, which I think is wrong, but I think they've just given up.
I think so. Perhaps maybe that goes back to the 19th century or something like that. So I guess I stand corrected, but I mean, you know, memoranda, referendum.
I think that they have probably just said, you know, schools are doing such a bad job teaching grammar these days. No one's going to listen anyway, so let's just go with referendums and say it's official, and we'll all be happy.
Just throw in the towels.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Tawa. Yeah. All right, so speaking of referendums, we were talking on the show earlier this week about the fact that Parti Québécois leader Paul Saint-Pierre Plamondon in Quebec has said if he wins the next provincial election, there will be a referendum in Quebec, a separatist referendum, and he is far ahead in the polls right now. So the chances of him winning, barring something catastrophic happening, are very good, which means we're probably going to be facing, at some point soon after 2026, another separatist move to get them out of Canada. Now, I don't know. My guest earlier in the week said he doesn't believe there is as much separatist sentiment in Quebec right now. So does something like this concern us, or is it just a nuisance, or is it what do we do with something like this?
That's a good question. I was thinking about it earlier this afternoon. I mean, I think I was more concerned, you know, the last time around, 95, right?
It was so close
and a different world back then with pre-9/11, and there seemed to be, you know, I mean, nowadays there's such apocalyptic talk in terms of from the climate to the Middle East to Russia and various things, that all of a sudden perhaps whether Quebec decides to separate or not doesn't seem as concerning. Or maybe I'm just getting old to not be as moved by it. You know, frankly, I find the talk interesting. I think it's kind of a throwback to you know, to the old days when this was, you know, top of mind for people. So I mean, it'd be interesting to see how it develops, and what to our points earlier, what the public sentiment really is in Quebec.
On that hand, you know, you would hope, although I hoped that last time it would have been the end, but maybe, you know, if it comes in and they lose 70-30 or 65-35 or something, they go, okay. But you just know that there is a solid core there that will keep chipping away and working to try and build it up. Interesting quote, though, that he said here, which I'm reading this and I'm thinking, okay, are we living on the same planet? Here was what he said when talking about this. Here's a quote. Canada has a dark future in store for us, Saint-Pierre Plamondon said. It's a regime that only wants to crush those who refuse to assimilate. Has one of the knocks against Canada recently been that we don't have any national identity, and everyone who comes here from another country with a different culture is encouraged in every way to hold on to their culture? This is the opposite of what I think a lot of people believe about us.
That quote jumped out at me as well. I mean, he's suggesting that Canada is a melting pot.
We're the opposite.
We're the opposite. That, you know, people are encouraged to maintain their cultural identities and so on. And
we're seeing protests on the street every day because people are not assimilating. And look, I don't. I'm not of the view that I think we should come over here and everyone should give up all of their culture.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you can argue that Canada has forced people to do that.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think it's that, you know, that as Bill Clinton said, you wouldn't think that dog would hunt. But you know, his language is interesting. I mean, he's got the hot words, and, you know, the regime, you know, which is used in the U.S. a lot. You know, we're, you know, some of the right talking about, you know, the Biden regime. It's sort of a dirty word. It has connotations of the jackbooted state kind of thing. And so I think he's trying to tap into anger. Is the anger there? I don't know. But that's what he's trying to do, I think. But that is the assimilation thing, you know, by the unitary federal state. Just, I don't know. I just don't think that washes.
The other part that I find so interesting about this is Quebec gets more transfer payments than any other province by a mile. Mm-hmm. And I still always go back to, okay, so if you do separate, I remember the last time when separation was being talked about in 95, and some of the questions were raised about, all right, what monetary unit do you use? What postal service do you use? What military protects you? What social, you know, services network and all? And they said, oh no, Canada will continue to provide that to us. And I'm like, wait a second. I'm pretty sure that if you would have voted to separate, we would have had our own referendum and Canadians would have said, yeah, too bad, so sad. You're on your own, Quebec.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I think it was argued pretty persuasively that they've had and have a pretty good deal.
Yep.
being in Canada, and I think, you know, the whole phrase like distinct society, you know, haven't been talked about much since back then. But you know, when you visit Quebec, it's a different place, and all the better. It's I love going to Montreal whenever I visit, kind of thing. You know, to try to argue that somehow they're being swallowed by.
But so is Atlantic Canada, and so is Vancouver.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's
all very distinct, and to suggest they're being swallowed by some sort of notion of federal Canadiana that doesn't really exist, I just don't know.
Yeah, the thing that worries me a lot more than Quebec separating at this point, truly, because I don't live there, I don't spend time there, so I don't really know, but lately I haven't got the sense that there is this groundswell, other than among political leadership, with probably leadership of a country aspirations. My concern more is if they do this, that there's a bunch of people in Alberta and Saskatchewan that say, we want to separate too, and it might plant some real ideas. And they actually, I think, would be more likely these days, especially if somehow Trudeau was to get reelected somehow, although that looks very unlikely. But if he were to get reelected, I believe you would have separatist movements out west.
No, you know what? That's actually a great point. The slippery slope, and if Trudeau did, you know, does win re-election, and the argument he made that, you know, and if Quebec separates, you know, Trudeau lost Quebec. You know, unlike his father, he was not able to keep Quebec in the Confederation kind of thing. And then, as you say, you didn't get Alberta saying, "Well, we've had enough," and there's now a precedent. You know what I mean? That for province to leave. It's a really interesting scenario.
But I would be worried even if Quebec didn't vote to leave, if a referendum came to be, that this might be enough to stage a referendum in Alberta. And I think that out west, probably there is more sentiment for separation right now than there is in Quebec.
Without seeing any data, I would agree with that 100% in terms of, the popular sentiment. And natural resources and how they feel they've been treated compared to Quebec by the federal government over the years and by Trudeau. I mean, there's a lot of anger out there. Obviously, I'm not stating the obvious. And but if Trudeau doesn't stay in power, that changes the dynamic entirely. Doesn't it?
Well, it does. And I think then the West probably feels mollified. But then you do wonder if Quebec, if this plays right into the hands then of Quebec. And but again, I find it hard to believe that if a gifted leader could not make the case to Quebec that, by the way, if you leave, here's what you're giving up, just so you... Because I think that was the one thing missing last time, that was there seemed to be this real belief that everything was going to stay as it was. You just get to be your own country. Mm-hmm. As opposed to say, no, if you leave, you are cut off and you don't get more money from us. You don't get this, you don't get that. You're... Now decide, but know that it's like a kid when, you know, I'm leaving home. And the parent's going, okay, but we're not paying for your groceries. We're not paying your rent. We're not paying your gas. We're not you're on your own. And you decide now.
The law of unintended consequences or the consequences to come. I have a vague recollection the last time around that it was in the final sort of hours of it when that sort of thing started being talked about more. Maybe that pushed it over the top the other way kind of thing. Because as you say, during that whole campaign, there wasn't much of that. It was just more about the our glorious future and the consequences could be easily dealt with kind of thing.
John, I got to tell you, this seems like a region of the world with multitudinous clenched sphincters right now because I have not talked to anybody who is a Leaf fan right now who is feeling like there's just like this overwhelming sense of here we go again, we're about to be smushed.
Boston.
It's got to be Boston.
Anybody but Boston, right?
Yeah. And it's just there's, and I mean, I kind of, well, not kind of, I do understand when you've been, when Boston has been the windshield and you have been the bug over and over and over again, I don't know that you should feel any overwhelming sense of confidence. And it doesn't matter who Boston's even, who's even playing for Boston.
Yeah.
If they got the jersey on, the sweater on, is it a surprise to you at all that there seems to be this overwhelming sense of brace yourself, here it comes?
I think, just by the numbers, at a certain point, even a Leafs fan's optimism starts to wane, I was thinking of the gambler's fallacy was, if you flip a coin and it's heads 10 times in a row, you start thinking, well, the next time is likely to be tails.
Yep.
Well, no, it's still 50-50.
Yep.
And so for Leaf fans, you think, this time, it's bound to be, it's bound to go differently. But at this point,
which is even less of a chance than that flipping a coin.
Yeah. Well,
right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. At least the coin is a pure 50-50.
That's right, yeah.
There's no mental block. There's no whatever else. It's, I just seems as though Leaf, I don't know who the Leafs offended back in the day.
Is there a curse or something?
We were talking, so Steve Milton, our former colleague, Steve Milton used to long hold to the curse of Frank Mihaljevic, that when the Leafs traded Frank Mihaljevic, that did them in.
To the Habs, that's right.
To Detroit first.
Oh, Detroit first, that's
to the
right.
Habs.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, and maybe, I don't know. It just seems as though Leaf fans are, there's always one. There's one in every sport, one team where the people are destined to live a life of misery.
I often think of these things in terms of narratives. And so, the irony or the narrative this time could be just as Leaf fans have decided there is no more hope, that's when they win. So
could be,
could be.
It's like someone who says, I'm never going to find a wife or a husband. And as soon as you stop looking, that person comes along.
That's a good analogy. Absolutely. So this could be it. I didn't used to care. I mean, as a Habs fan, I was quite happy to see the Leafs lose all the time. But I'm at the point now, it's kind of like, Yeah, let's see them get, you were saying earlier, get to the finals. You know what I mean? I don't care if they win, but let them get to the finals.
You and I, we were born around the same time. Neither of us sitting here right now have ever been alive to see the Leafs in the finals. We've not been on this earth when they were in the finals, which is just stunning when you consider what NHL teams have been there. Teams that are irrelevant. They matter. I mean, I know Carolina might matter to people in Carolina, but
Vegas.
Carolina, winning. Anaheim. Go down the list. It's just this like litany of teams that are meaningless in the grand scheme of things, and yet they've all been there.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, the Leafs continue to maintain their an iconic status as in terms of a brand, I guess, right? In the U.S., I think they're still seen as being, the real marquee Canadian team, I think. So there's that. Kind of like the, I'm also, I hesitate to mention a Dallas Cowboys fan, but I'm getting to Leaf fan stage with the Cowboys where you're living in the past glory from many years ago.
Yeah, so now be a Leaf fan and a Buffalo Bills fan. You combine those two when you bring up the Cowboys.
That's right.
And you throw in Ticats fans who are the longest suffering. Like around this, Blue Jays can't do anything, not since 93. Mm. They've been, they
That's
had
right.
2015 and 16 with that team. They were close, but Ticats, not since 99. Buffalo Bills, never. Mm-hmm. Toronto Maple Leafs, not since 1967. Who am I forgetting? Raptors did it once, but now they're back to where they'll be probably for the next 20 years, which is nothing.
I mean, I guess, you know, the Bills versus Leafs fan, you know, better to have loved and lost repeatedly, like the Bills, or not have loved at all, like the Leafs, who haven't got to the finals.
That's a tough question. There are people in therapy for questions like that. So you know, the thing I wonder though always, and I don't believe for a second that the Leafs are playing this for this purpose, but do you believe that if the Leafs ever were to win, that it would diminish something about the fan base? That part of the intrigue of this team and what keeps fans so connected is the chase. That if you ever actually, if you were the race dog that ever caught the rabbit at the track, they would stop running. You would just become disinterested.
It's an interesting point. I think, you know, like the Boston Red Sox, like when they won years ago, I think they gone decades, yep, haven't they?
So Cubs,
the Cubs even better, you know. And you know, and I think some people argue that with the Cubbies, that they lost something there, you know, the Wrigley Field, the lovable losers, and all of that. And so, you know, the Leafs, I mean, over the years, all my life, 67, remember 67 and all that, and there'll be no more of that, you know. And so I think they would lose something, but I'm sure they're willing to take that chance anyways.
But I mean, I even wonder, and it's not a, we'll never know. Well, we might if they ever do something, but if financially it would impact the Leafs. I mean, you would have a huge surge in shirts bought and memorabilia and everything for their Stanley Cup championship, but do ticket values go down? Because we've seen it now. You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I do wonder if there might be something that the perpetual Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill is more intriguing than actually getting the rock to the top of the hill. And then, well, we've seen it. Then when they stink again, which is inevitable, I don't need to watch because, you know, I'll come back when they're good again.
The best Rocky movie ever is the one where he loses.
The first one. So that was a spoiler for anyone who didn't watch it in 1977 or 76, it was.
So there you go.
We did this twice in the last week, giving away spoiler. We gave a spoiler alert for Wizard of Oz the other day. I don't know what the statute of limitations on spoilers is, but I guess if you haven't seen Rocky 1 by now, that's on you, not on us.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
All right, as I say, great guest in today. We had a great hour, just flew by the first hour, and let's keep going. His name is John Wells. He is a man who has won more awards writing for The Spectator with his often long-form pieces than, I don't think there's anyone at the paper who's won more than John has. His dusting bill, his cleaning lady that comes in and has to clean the awards twice a week. It's a full-time job. You have her on. She's on salary now, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's
Marguerite, she's in there for 2 days a week, just cleaning all the awards. And
getting some arthritis, unfortunately.
Carpal tunnel.
Yeah, it happens, right?
Yeah, but it's good that you provide benefits as well for this, for those surgeries. Thanks for coming in. It's a, we got a lot of stuff to get to, including I want to talk to you about when I talk about your long-form stuff. You just have a new really great piece out about a story in the Waterloo region. But before we get to that, this week I saw something that I watched a bit of. I couldn't actually bring myself to watch the whole thing only because it was the kind of thing, it was one of those TED Talks. Hmm. And everyone knows I think everyone knows what TED Talks are. They're like, 12 minutes or 15 minute, like mini lectures on some issue that people, experts in a certain field give. And John, I had to cut myself off it because it was making me jittery from just watching this. Okay, so here it is. It is the woman who was the head of Wikipedia, now is the the CEO of NPR, National Public Radio in the States. Her name is Catherine Maher, or Mayer, I'm not sure, Maher, don't know how you pronounce her last name. And she was talking about other things, but one of the things she got to in this talk was about the idea of truth. Mm. Our reverence for the truth might be a distraction getting in the way of finding common ground and getting things done. In other words, truth is kind of a speed bump to what we really need to do. But then she got on to the really stuff that really... Here's another quote. She didn't say that truth doesn't exist. She simply says there are many different truths. So, quote, and so in the spirit of that, I'm certain the truth exists for you and probably for the person sitting next to you, but it may not be the same truth. This is because the truth of the matter is very often for many people what happens when we merge facts about the world with our beliefs about the world. So we all have different truths. Mm. This drives me, John, this drives me insane because she is saying the word truth when what she is meaning is opinion. Mm-hmm. You have an opinion. I have an opinion. That's what that is. But the idea that there is no truth, or we can never know a truth, or we should ignore truth to just get the opinion that we can all agree upon, it infuriates me.
I think you know, the word truth, you know, we talk about standards of grammar and language changing and evolving, and maybe not for the good, that the meaning of the word truth kind of ceases to kind of mean anything anymore when you start talking about multiple truths or speak your truth. I'm not opposed to the notion of someone speaking how they feel about something passionately.
Of course.
Based on their experiences and their own context. That's all very, that's a good thing. We need to express that differently. It's not about speaking your truth. It's about speaking your opinion or speaking your perspective.
Yeah.
A very valuable thing. But you know, I guess, you know, we're both journalists, and the notion, you know, the word truth kind of has a shine to it for us, I think, in terms of gathering facts and trying to be objective and all of that. And you know, her quotes, it's a scary thing to me when really seeing something like that, because what's the slippery slope there when you know, meaning and truth ceases to kind of have any validity anymore?
Well, I don't think, I mean, yes, we're both journalists in here, but I don't think that you have to be a journalist to believe strongly that there is truth and that we should want to believe that something. I mean, if we go by her definition of this, so we all have different truths, you cannot have a criminal justice system.
Mm, right.
Because John Wells goes out and murders someone, and I say, I saw John do that, and you say, no, you didn't. That's not my truth.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Whose truth then trumps whose truth?
Yeah,
whose truth gets to be the truth?
That would be an extreme example where
sure it would.
Where evidence or facts cease to mean anything. You know, we assess, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt kind of thing. Well, that's a high bar to meet kind of thing that needs to be met.
But if that would be your truth in that example, and by the way, for the record, as far as I know, John has not gone out and murdered anyone. That was just an example. But in that example, if your truth is that you have not done what is alleged to be doing, that alleged to have been done, even though other people say their truth is that they saw you, your truth is that they didn't, a judge could not, if we all have a different truth, make a decision on what is the truth, because there is no real truth.
No, that's right. And, you know, and certainly in court, in criminal court, you know, the whole issue of motive is always a factor in convictions, say. So I suppose, you know, you can have a case where, you know, the Crown proves that, you know, the motive, the person stole money and drugs from the dealer and shot him dead. The motive was that was not my motive. My motive was based on an inner truth that you just don't understand, and it's more complicated than that. Even though there's no evidence to that, and so you, I mean that would be you take it far beyond articles and journalism to our actual criminal justice system. That's a frightening slippery slope indeed.
But you could like, again, to follow this idea that everybody has, and like I call this the Oprahfication of our world, because I think that Oprah was the one, I think, who really was, this is your truth. It was kind of her thing to be your truth, but it doesn't have to be as extreme an example. Running a red light. You know, now we have red light cameras now, but what if there's no camera? What if it is just the cop's word against your word? He saw you or she saw you run a red light, and not my truth. And even things like our here's where this is becoming a real issue. Our history. We now have, I don't think, any ability to agree or to have a history. Our country at this point, I believe, has a vacuum for history, because we have people saying, that's your history, this is my history, that's your truth, this is my truth. How do you decide whose truth is the truth that's going to be the truth?
I mean, I think you would think at one time there was a greater sense of objective history, accepted fact, accepted versions of the past when historians have researched events, gathered primary documents, and presented their findings on things that have occurred. And but you get sort of revisionist history. It's not to say things shouldn't be reconsidered and with new information and seen through different lenses to perhaps arrive at more accurate representations of events, kind of thing. But when you start to have no accepted version of historical events, because it all comes down to one's interpretation, especially for people who haven't actually researched the facts, but just becomes a matter of opinion and perspective, mm-hmm. and how it makes you feel. Then I think we're, you know, you mentioned this topic earlier, and I was like, you know, George Orwell talked about, you know, the notion of objective truth kind of fading. And this was back in the early 40s or something. So this is something that's been warned about for a long time. But I think never has it been more of a critical issue than now in the age of social media and so much information being thrown out there.
Did the Holocaust happen?
Well, that's the gold
standard.
I
mean, I believe 100% that the Holocaust happened.
And it's historically proven, but there are obviously people who deny it. You know, I think to take a less sobering example, I think of the moon landing.
Uh-huh.
You know,
perfect.
I know a person who you know, maybe we all know someone who denies the moon landing as being established history. And you know, and that Neil Armstrong did what he did in a soundstage and lived the rest of his life by a giant lie. And his whole biography, this is the things I tell this person, this whole biography of his is just one big conspiracy that's been held all the... So, you know, that's again, an extreme example, I suppose, but that's where you get at with this.
We just had last week, and I don't want to get into his story again because I think we've exhausted it more than I ever want to, but the O.J. Simpson trial.
Mm.
Oh, I mean, O.J. Simpson, far as we know, died never other than writing the book saying, if I did it, which was... but nonetheless, to our best of our knowledge, he never... came out and said, I did it. Whether that means that he convinced himself that he didn't, but that became his truth. So what value does his truth hold?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's, yeah. And you know, that notion of, I mean, I think, you know, we probably see it in everyday life. People who believe a lie enough and repeat it long enough, it becomes their truth, and other people will accept it. You know, the big lie theory. Eventually, enough people may well accept that. That's the scary thing, you know. And you know, we saw that in Nazi Germany in terms of the, you know, the stab in the back and all this sort of thing that Hitler, that, you know, that a pretty much a democratic country came to the masses came to believe because it was repeated often enough and with enough force that the lie was believed.
But this whole thing starts again with this this person who had been the head of Wikipedia and some of the other stuff. We don't even have time to get into some of the other things that were mm-hmm. said that make you shake your head. But the irony of this is that I think her saying that everybody has their own truth is truth to a lot of people, which is even more ironic. Now you're getting into like a spiraling rabbit hole of truthiness or mm-hmm. not truthiness.
Yeah. And you know, and Wikipedia. I mean, Wikipedia is a real lightning rod for controversy for a lot of people, and in the journalistic profession occupation, it is as well. You know, I mean, I tell people I use Wikipedia all the time as a starting point. I repeat, starting point into researching something.
Yeah.
The key thing is that it offers footnotes to other articles that you can dive into to hunt and gather as much as you can.
Yeah.
To come up with some truth, to come up with your facts. And
all right, it says that Bob hunted a deer when he was six. You don't rely on that, but okay, I can go and see if somewhere else will say that this existed.
Exactly, and you can, that's where you can use your online information to gather all sorts of other things, kind of thing. But you know, I think nowadays people exist in these echo chambers where they see that Bob killed the deer, and they accept that as truth, or conversely, they say it has to be a lie because it's coming from that certain source without checking it out and without kind of trying to balance things out. You know what I mean? But that's it seems to be a lost art.
As I say, this, when I saw her giving this talk, and it was in the, people can go and watch it. They can find it online. It's in the sort of, her voice is that sort of almost, come on in, kind of, you know, like really calm. Like, she doesn't come across like she's a lunatic.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think she's a lunatic. I just think this idea is so problematic that we need to essentially get past the need to have truth so that we can find something that we agree upon. And that again, to me, that's a problematic place to be. That it doesn't matter what's true anymore, mm-hmm. as long as we agree that it's a good thing or whatever, that's fine.
And who's she mentions common ground. Who's common ground? You know what I mean? Like, so we can all come to agreement on common ground, but that's a matter of opinion in terms of what we should all accept as being the standard for whatever issue it might be. You know what I mean? Whether it's LRT and saying, let's all come to common ground and the facts be damned kind of thing. Well, it depends where you stand.
Well, the Emperor's New Clothes, right? That's a perfect example. Everybody in that fictional fable, mm-hmm. everyone told the Emperor that he had wonderful clothes. So they all came to an agreement, except for the one person who actually had the truth. But in her version of the world, the one person who had the truth, because many more didn't, but they agreed on a truth, mm-hmm. they would be right, and they would be the ones holding the truth, which would be the opposite. It's very Orwellian, as mm-hmm. you use that phrase.
Absolutely.
I would encourage people to go and watch this thing just to infuriate themselves. So maybe they disagree. Maybe they are entirely on board with the idea that everyone gets to have their own truth, and if you can simply find enough disciples and acolytes, that you get to make up your truth, become the truth. But boy, that seems like it's a weird place to live.
Mm-hmm.
John Wells is in studio with me. John, who is a longtime writer at the Hamilton Spectator. You, I'm sure, have read his stuff, whether it was, your first real long was Poison, right?
Yes.
So people will remember that one. And there's been many, many since. And the latest one is called Forsaken. It's a long headline. 14 years, 140 officers, and a dark secret that consumed a small Ontario town. How the Lucas Shortreed case was solved. So before we get into this, give us the Reader's Digest version of the story here.
Right. So in 2008, Lucas Shortreed, 18-year-old teenager who lived in Fergus, which is just north of Guelph, was killed in a hit and run on Thanksgiving weekend. He was walking down a darkened county road, walking on the paved part of the road. He'd been drinking at a party. He was killed, a hit and run, and the driver of the car was never found. A huge police investigation went on for years. A lot of finger pointing in town about who might have done it, and this big mystery. And of course, the family's in great pain, and the communities too. Everyone loved Lucas. And 14 years later, the driver of the car is found thanks to a tip from the public. The police investigate. It turned out the driver had hidden his badly damaged Dodge Neon that had hit Lucas. He had hid it in a trailer in his backyard, like a 5-minute drive from the accident scene.
Sounds like we just watched a series called Dead to Me on Netflix, which was a similar story, it was actually kind of a semi-comedy. There's no comedy in this one. This is a tragic, tragic story that, you know, the thing that strikes me about this, and it's like so many other great stories, is other than a few people, not everyone knows this story to begin with. Right? It's not. This is not like we just mentioned OJ. It's not like the entire world is covering the OJ trial. This is a tiny, relatively tiny story with few participants, 140 officers, but still. Mm-hmm. But you find these kind of nuggets of a story, and you can then turn it into something.
Yeah, yeah. No, when you think of some high-profile, homicide case in Hamilton, the Bosma case, and different things like that, where it's been covered by national media and certainly the Spectator and local media a lot. This one was covered by local media in the Wellington County area. And by the Waterloo Region Record, not a big profile kind of thing. When I first heard, when my editor suggested I do the story, and I heard sort of the elements of the story, I thought, wow, this has potential. You know, there's a cover up, there's a tragic death, and all the years that pass before it's solved. So I thought this could be a strong story.
Could there not be Could there not be 100 of these though?
In terms of cases that are unsolved?
In cases that are unsolved that have mm-hmm. ingredients that you could turn into something.
Yeah, well, it's true. And, it's funny, I've heard from, I've heard from a couple of local Hamilton people who have family members who were victims of hit-and-run cases that were never solved. And so they're asking me about doing a story. You know, it's so many of these don't ever get solved. There are other cases elsewhere in Ontario where, they could all... Everyone's got a story, and there's lots of tragedy out there, unfortunately, people's lives, and they're You know, I've been taken aback by the feedback I've had in the story. So much positive feedback on the story in terms of how, and I guess in terms of how I told it, and sympathy for the family and outrage at the driver. Because I think it's a story that has sort of those elements that people can identify with. You know, it's not a case of a drug dealer that's gunned down in a drive-by shooting or whatever. There's a young life's been taken, and the notion of someone covering up something that that could happen to any of us, really. This driver was on a dark road. He didn't react in time, whether he had time or not. The judge didn't think that was a factor, the driving. You know, the wrong place, wrong time. It could have been one of us kind of thing. So I think that notion appeals and perhaps frightens readers.
But, you know, you mentioned the Bosma case, which it is interesting to me that, okay, so what you just described is this is one of those things that we could imagine could happen to us. The mm-hmm. Bosma case, taking your car or your truck out for a test drive.
Yeah, Kijiji, yeah.
But it's fascinating how one of them becomes a national story that everybody is covering and knows every detail, and there's books written and everything else, and this one, not at all.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's. I think part of that is the nature of a death. I mean, for better or worse, I mean, you know, true crime in terms of homicide intrigues lots of people, and this case was not a homicide. You know, it was an unsolved hit and run for years, and there was no trial, as I relate in the story. It was a one day sentencing hearing. Whereas, you know, Bosma or you know, the poison case with Sequinder Dillon and cases like this where there are long trials with lots of twists and turns to mm-hmm. them and people, you know, courtroom drama, homicide. Some of these stories sort of have all the elements that make for a compelling piece. And this one certainly had some of them. But, you know, the whole small town thing, you know, I spent a fair bit of time in Fergus, you know, went to the cemetery and this type of piece, I mean, it's an interesting one to tell, where you're sort of taking something, as you know, as you said, something small in a small community, one, you know, one family, and then you're sort of essentially expanding it and blowing up into a very large sort of epic length piece. You know,
one of the things that really strikes me about this and the other ones too is that something like this, we see, not to compare it exactly, but I think there's a comparison. We see stories like this that would be covered, excuse me, by like Dateline NBC or 2020 or something.
Yeah.
And they will have teams of people that are working on the story, whether it's camera people, reporters, editors, information, whatever. You're doing this by yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a totally different world when you're... same idea. In the end, you get a similar product, but a way different way of going about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And I, you know, from the start, back in the fall when I started working on it, I wondered if other media would get involved, because the more I sort of dug into the story, I thought this is quite compelling and dark and tragic and all of that. It was just me, and you know my first interview was with the mother of the boy who died, and she the very first day I spent time with her, we went to the cemetery. She showed me his stone, and we went for a drive up to where the spot was where he was killed. And I spent the afternoon with her. It was one of those interviews where I thought, if I get nothing else from anybody with this story, if the rest of the family doesn't talk, if no friends talk, if the police don't talk to me, which is entirely possible, I will have this. And this will be the anchor of the story. Now I'll write about the mother's pain. And that day we took that drive in the car in the rain kind of thing. And she sort of established Judy Moore, Lucas's mother, she established the emotional foundation of the story. And from there, I knew that's how I would end the story. And I thought, now what else can I gather to build to that close? And that was the process from October until essentially March.
Do you think there's still, so I mentioned like these reality TV shows that show these kind of things. Is there still value in long form journalism in the written sense?
Value to
to the readers, to people who are going to read. I mean, like, obviously you're going to feel strongly about this because you produced it. But sure. When you're sitting, before you got started into this, mm-hmm. what's the compelling reason that you would say, as you're getting started on this, that what's the value to, when you pitch it to an editor? Mm-hmm. Now I know this one; they pitched it to you. Yes. But what's the reason we would want to do this?
Right, a couple of things. I've often thought about this with some of my other crime stories, because sometimes you wonder. I mean, you're delving into some dark territory sometimes, and you wonder what the value is. And you know, I don't watch a lot of true crime things myself. I just tend to write about them once in a while. But for this one, certainly, I think there's value in introducing readers, introducing people to a victim and painting a full portrait of that person. You know, there was no trial in this case, so there was no sort of testimony or public attention being paid to who Lucas Shortreed was, kind of thing. So I often think about cases like this where there's not a lot of attention, where it's my chance to kind of paint that portrait, put clothes on the person and sort of introduce the people to this victim and this life that was taken away. I think there's teaching points with a story like this in terms of driving. You know, the driver had been drinking that night, although intoxication was not sort of considered part of the case against him by the judge. But so there are some learning points in that, and you know, and not, I've had readers email and say, you know, thank you for drawing attention to the importance of staying at the scene of a hit and run kind of thing. You know what I mean? That there's something to be, you know, and just exploring the human condition. I mean, what was going through this guy's mind, who would not only flee the scene, which you could imagine someone doing that in a panic, but then deciding to cover this up for 14 years and living with that lie. There's value in exploring the human condition and where, you know, how far people will go. I think with my crime stories, I've tried to sort of explore that in terms of whether it's the person who's committed a crime or the person who's the victim of a crime, or how family and loved ones deal with that kind of unspeakable pain.
What about the idea of long form journalism? Because it's a long story. I don't know how many inches it is. It's a long story.
Over 200 inches, yeah.
At a time when we are getting a lot of our information from TikTok or X or Twitter, or, you know, our attention span is like that of a gnat. Most of us can't remember what we had for breakfast.
Right.
Are people sticking around to read the whole thing, or has this carved the audience into a very segmented group that will read it and those who won't?
That's, well, the last part of that is the question that I can't quite answer. But I know this particular piece, I've had unprecedented feedback from it, positive feedback from readers who said that, you know, that it was worth the read. And there's been a lot of, you know, the Spectator gauges the online engagement, they call the time people spend reading. So there are lots of people who've been reading it from start to finish. Whether that's a critical mass of people or not, I don't know. I think there's value in, well, you know what? I mean, you look at some of these streamed shows, even for the short attention span, you have people who will marathon these series in seasons and seasons of the favorite show. People are willing to spend the time with the story.
If it's worth it.
If it's worth it to them for whatever reason that might be. And I think long form journalism, if it's done well, I think you can hook people in. I try to write these pieces sort of visually, almost opening with scenes and trying to have these sort of teases that will get people locked in so that they'll stay with me through the rest of the story. I think this story does that really well. And certainly had help with editing with editors to help facilitate that, but that was my intention. And I think, you know, a good movie, a good series. That, I mean, you know, you look at some of these streamed series, and they're just it's masterful how, you know, with halfway through the first episode, people are hooked. They talk about that, and I think long form journalism can do that as well. If it's done poorly, unfortunately, people will be turned off immediately,
yes.
And they might not look at a long story again, and that's the risk.
And when you talk about those series, like I remember in the episode one or two of Breaking Bad, I can't remember.
Yeah.
At that moment said, oh, I got to watch this whole thing. Like, you were immediately locked in. But you're right. There have been other ones that I will start watching and you're an episode in. You go, oh, it may get great after this, but I am not going to risk.
Yeah. And you're waiting.
Taking that time.
You're waiting to be taken by it, you know.
You want to.
Yeah, no, that's
you
right.
Want to, but the piece is called Forsaken, 14 years, 140 officers, and a dark secret that consumed a small Ontario town. It is up at the Waterloo Region Records website. It's at the Specs website. It is on the Toronto Star's website. You can find it around if you just look for Forsaken and John Wells, J-O-N, not J-O-H-N, J-O-N, although you probably get that all the time.
Oh, yeah.
J-O-N Wells, you'll find it. It is, grab a tea and carve out half an hour of your day, and it's worth a read. For sure. We learned today, well, we knew that the Arizona Coyotes were leaving and Utah is getting an NHL team. And we learned there are 22,700 deposits for NHL season tickets in Utah.
Wow.
So do we take from that that NHL hockey is going to be just a wondrous success in Utah, or do we take nothing from that?
I think we take very little from that just because it's new and fresh.
And the deposits were $100, refundable.
Oh, well, I did not know that. So that's maybe all you need to know. No, I think, you know, there's that obviously that initial euphoria, another major league sport, you know, coming to Utah. But it's the staying power. And I think that, you know, I think it boils down to the marketing that goes into it from here and whether they can win. I think you look at Vegas. I mean, they've done really well in terms of the fan base, right? I mean, but the
Utah is not getting a team like Vegas.
No,
they're getting the Arizona Coyotes,
and there you go. Yeah. So if they're a loser, I don't know how long that enthusiasm begins, but Utah is north of Arizona, so they've got that going for them.
Every time we have one of these things where a new team, they say, oh, we've got, you know, how many thousand season tickets? I've always thought it's a fool's errand to talk about how many deposits are in for NHL season tickets, unless you were to say, you've got to put down a deposit and give us your credit card. And if we get the team, you're in for 3 years and you have to pay your full price. So it's non-refundable, the cost of the season ticket. So you're in for, you know, 30 grand or whatever. Then we'll see how many seasons, because I have a feeling that an awful lot of people would do exactly what I would do, where I'd put down my $100 refundable deposit, go home and tell my wife, guess what? We just, and she's like, wait, you want to spend $35,000 on season tickets? Yeah, no, we're not doing that.
Right.
And I would say, can I have my money back, please? I do not think that there's 14,000 seats in this arena. It's going to be expanded apparently to 17. I'll be shocked if they have 6,000 season tickets.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Once you whittle out all the people who just went, I better get in line.
Right. Yeah. And as you say, they're getting a used team as opposed to the Vegas having the draft, right, where they get to draw players from other, and maybe you can get an interesting mix, you know. So that's I just don't know.
It drives me nuts that. You know, they're going to make a big deal again about all the tickets that are moving and everything. But you put this in Quebec City, or, you know, I'm not even going to go down the path of Hamilton. We talked about, but you know, you put this in Quebec City, you're not even talking about how many season ticket deposits you get, because it's a foregone conclusion. You know, you're sold out every night.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, it's part of the cultural landscape, like it would be in Hamilton. I'll say it. And down there, you know, can they? Hockey in the southern, or everywhere in the U.S., is no longer a secret. Professional hockey, so there's that. But again, I still think of it being down there as being something of a novelty, unless they win. If the team all of a sudden turns around, if they draft a young Connor McDavid type player that they can sell the marketing on, well then maybe they start bringing fans out. I'm curious to see what they do with the name and color scheme and all that sort of thing. I always find that pretty fascinating.
Well, let's see. Not Arizona anymore. I can't say that. Utah is going to have the sixth. I just had to look this up. The sixth best odds to win the NHL draft. Now there is no Austin Matthews or Connor Bedard this year, so you don't. There's nobody who that we know of is going to be a generational player,
right?
And yet, the cynic, conspiracy theorist in me is like, how awkward will it look for the NHL if somehow Utah was to win the draft this year?
Oh, look at this!
You know, it's almost like there was an old story from the very first year the NBA ever had a draft. I don't know if you've ever heard this story, but Patrick Ewing.
I think I know where you're going, yes.
So Patrick Ewing was the big star coming out of Georgetown, 7-foot center, dominant player. And the rumor that has never been confirmed, they had big envelopes in a drum. And one of them had been in a freezer and was frozen.
Yes.
So that when he reached in, they all looked the same, but whoever it was, the commissioner or whatever, could find the frozen one.
David Stern, I think, probably pulling it up.
It might have been Stern, or it might have been before him, Larry O'Brien. But anyway, whoever it was. But you could make sure that the Knicks won because they were the marquee franchise. And
right.
I almost think you freeze Arizona's ping pong balls this time to make sure they don't win, because it will look so bad if you go to a new city and they win the draft right away. There will be no one who will believe this was on the up and up.
The fix will be in. Yeah, no, exactly. To talk about conspiracy theories, that one will be going strong.
Even though, you know, if you've watched the NHL draft thing, I don't know how you could rig it with the ping pong balls. Like, it seems pretty unriggable. Again, if you've got a guy who's a dominant generational player, this is probably not the year for them to win. Mm-hmm. Gary Bettman is praying they don't win this year.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
I would think.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll see how they do. I can tell you how they would do if it was in Quebec, I think, or even here in Hamilton, or honestly, you put them in London, Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they would do as well as they will in Utah.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, drawing from, I mean, I always thought about Hamilton. I mean, Hamilton would become London's team, we've drawn from everywhere. You know, I'm sure fans in Hamilton will think about that again with yet another city getting a team before Hamilton does.
I did see that the two names that stood out that are possible names that were, I guess someone found the trademark application.
Mm.
And one of them was Utah HC for Utah Hockey Club.
Okay, which so sounds sort of a soccer thing.
Which is, whatever.
Yeah.
And the other one was the Utah Blizzard, which I'm guessing Dairy Queen is going to file a lawsuit immediately upon application. It's like, you can't name it after our dessert.
I always get a kick out of how, the Utah Jazz, the NBA team, that they came from New Orleans,
yes,
a city of jazz, to Utah, to Salt Lake.
A city of not much jazz.
Not much jazz at all. So I always find that interesting when the name's just, or the Lakers for that matter.
Yeah, from Minneapolis.
To LA, where there was a dearth of water, and all of a sudden they're the Lakers. So
somebody did suggest online that in the spirit of the Utah Jazz, that has nothing to do with the state, that they should name the hockey team the Utah Dolphins. Just right. As a totally non sequitur.
Now you're talking,
something just completely, what could be the least Utah thing ever?
A dolphin jumping over a mountain or something like that.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
Yeah, the Utah Fornicators. just come up with like the thing that they're least. Well, I don't know if that's what they're least known for.
It's the University of Utah. They're the Utes, Utes, which I looked up. I wasn't sure if that was just sort of a made up. It's a tribe, the Ute tribe, apparently.
I thought it was from My Cousin Vinny. The two Utes.
that would be a good one, actually. But it's from a tribe, which I guess there, that's still okay, I guess, given the controversies elsewhere with that sort of thing.
I did not know that they were is the Utah is Utah the name of a tribe?
The Utes apparently is the Ute tribe in Utah, and with the whole with name appropriation these days being an issue, I was like, oh really? I guess they're okay with that down in Utah. But there you go.
John Wells, thanks for coming in and doing this today.
Thanks, Scott.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.